Thank you for coming. So I will be discussing home birth safety by focusing on several recent cohort studies. So I have no financial disclosures to make. So home birth. So I'm typically referring to planned home birth. So this is when a woman intends to give birth at home with the assistance of a skilled birth attendant. So there's a birthing plan in place in case of unexpected complications. So the actual delivery may end up taking place in the hospital due to complications. So the debate regarding this practice safety is occurring here in the U.S. and other developed nations. And we've seen a growing interest in this practice and also increases in its rates, particularly here in the U.S., which have further spurred on the debate regarding its safety. Now, at the heart of this debate is concern over the potential increased risk for maternal and infant morbidity and mortality outcomes as a result of inadequate access to life-saving interventions that are only found in hospitals. Thus, when an unexpected complication occurs, the woman and the infant need to be transferred to receive that additional care, and the transfer can take time and delay the initiation of treatment. As a result, multiple studies have been conducted to assess home birth safety, and it's this body of literature that is currently being used to support the stances of multiple professional medical associations' view on the practice of planned home birth. So here in the U.S., Australia, and New Zealand, they do not support, endorse the practice of home birth. Well, in the U.K. and the Netherlands, they do. And Canada does, but it's more on a state-by-state basis. So these current studies that assess home birth safety have to account for key birthing characteristics in their analyses. And here are three such. So when a woman selects a birthing site, she's also selecting a possible birth attendant. And these can be grouped into two main broad categories, which is physicians and midwives. Midwives can be further categorized based on whether or not they have an additional nursing degree. So of these three broad attendant categories, they have slight differences in their training background and also variations to their approach to the overall birthing process. So in your analyses, you would want to account for who's assisting in the birth because they are helping and they could affect the outcomes. I do want to point out that not all home births are planned. You have unplanned home births that have been found to be at an increased risk for negative birth outcomes due to having lower skilled birth attendants or also being higher risk births. So typically home births are only offered to low risk women, but the precise criteria for home birth does vary. Medium and high risk women can find birth attendants, so they can still give birth at home. So this was a critical review with a primary objective of to contribute to and inform the debate by providing an assessment of the methods and conclusions from cohort studies that specifically compare home births to hospital births. So in order to do this, I selected several outcomes that are in the literature. I focused on infant outcomes, three in particular. So infant mortality and two measures of infant morbidity. So there are a lot of other infant morbidity measures that could have been included, but I chose these two. Additionally, the literature also assesses maternal outcomes as well as birth interventions, which are I will not discuss. This is the list of the inclusion criteria that assisted me in finding studies. I did try to focus on newer, more recent cohorts, but some of the studies did straddle several decades, so I allowed the data to go back to the 80s. Just to point out, some of the studies did not have to have all of my outcomes of interest. They had to have at least one, and in those cases, they tended to be mortality-focused studies. So the study identification process. So we used PubMed and Google Scholar, and with keywords such as home birth safety, home birth compared to hospital birth, midwives, and home birth. And based on accounting for being in English, my time period, and they had to be conducted in a developed country, based on titles only, I extracted 110 manuscripts. Through multiple exclusion rounds, I ended up with 15 cohort studies that had at least one home birth group and one hospital comparison group. So of these 15 studies, they came from 7 different countries. 5 of the studies were actually U.S.-based. So they used 3 main sources of data, which were midwifery databases, state and national birth registries, and birth and death certificates. Most of the studies focused on low-risk women. All but 3 focused on planned location, and most were able to provide information regarding the birth attendants. For some of the studies, they could only provide information regarding who attended the home birth, but did not give any information of who attended the hospital birth. So now looking at a brief snapshot of the overall findings of these studies. So this is only 13 studies, because two were just morbidity studies. So of the mortality outcomes, there are multiple time periods that are assessed for infant mortality, and the terms that are used, the time periods covered by them do vary, and some studies combine terms to cover a broader time period. So I went ahead and grouped by time period rather than the term. So if we just focus on the mortality ones and not the combined, which is the one at the bottom, only one study that focused on low-risk women planned birth location and provided some information regarding birth attendants found home births to be at an increased risk for mortality during labor and delivery. This was a U.S.-based study using birth and death certificates, and it covered quite a few decades. Now moving on to the combined study. So this was a English study, and it was a prospective cohort, and they had actually a mixed finding. So they found that women that this was their first pregnancy, they may be at an increased risk for this combined outcome. But they, in the end, still concluded that home birth could be a safe birthing choice for low-risk women because the outcomes were so rare. And I want to point out, for all these studies, the outcomes are extremely rare. In some cases, the comparison groups would only have two or five deaths. So the addition of one or two deaths will have a significant impact on the findings. So overall, it doesn't appear, based on the low-risk planned birth location and knowing the birth attendants, that there is an increased risk for mortality, but there may be some variation by country because it's primarily the U.S. studies finding the increased risk. Now moving on to morbidity. Like I mentioned, I only looked at two outcomes. So let's first focus on the admission to the NICU. So the five studies that assessed NICU admission, none found home births to be at an increased risk, while three found hospital births to be at an increased risk. And two of these were U.S. studies, and the authors suggested that this may be due to having a lower entry criteria for the hospital births because they're already present in the hospital. The next morbidity outcome was Apgar scores. So the literature used a 1 minute or a 5 minute and cut points of 4 and 7. So again, looking with the criteria of low risk, focused studies, planned birth location, and knowing the birth attendants, there doesn't appear to be an increased risk for low Apgar score. But there is some variation in release with this morbidity because some studies found no association while others found hospital births to be at an increased risk and some found home births to be at an increased risk. And those were, again, U.S. studies. So we may be seeing some variation by country. So in conclusion, this review is only focusing on 15 studies of a very large body of literature and only focusing on three of the available outcomes. But just looking at these outcomes, we do see a high level of heterogeneity in the results. And it's not clear that these differences are completely due to variations in methodology or differences based on the fact that these studies occurred in 7 different nations with varying levels of integration and support for home birth. But I would like to talk about some of the methodological limitations of these studies. So the first off is exposure misclassification. So like I mentioned, most studies focus on planned birth location. So that means you need to account for unplanned home births and account for transfers to hospitals. And when you don't do this, you end up with differential exposure misclassification. And they have varying impacts on the results. As you can see, including unplanned home births can overestimate the risk, while not accounting for transfers can underestimate the risk. Some studies have issues with one of these, while other studies have difficulties accounting for both. So in those cases, it becomes more difficult to determine whether or not the results are being over or underestimated based on the exposure misclassification. Now moving on to the birth risk level. So the majority of studies focus on low-risk women because those are who are recommended to give birth at home. However, medium and high-risk women are still giving birth at home, so there is reason to include them in analyses. But if you do choose to include them, you need to control for birth risk level, because if you don't, you're going to overestimate the risk for the low-risk woman. The next is the unknown birth attendants. So the primary purpose of these studies is to focus on the planned birth location. And in order to do that, you need your comparison groups as similar as possible, and that includes birth attendants. So when you don't know the birth attendant, it makes it more difficult to interpret the results because you do not know if the differences you're seeing can be attributed to the different birth locations or variations in the birth attendant. This still holds true for when you do know the birth attendant, such as when you have a home birth attended by a midwife and a hospital birth attended by a physician, because you still have differences in the birth attendants. And the last one I'm going to point out is the source data. So the main sources that are being utilized are national and state birth registries, large midwifery databases, and birth and death certificates, because you need such large sample sizes to get at these rare outcomes. Now, all of these sources are going to have varying levels of missing information and issues with reliability and validity, some more than others. So you need to try to minimize these issues with your data as much as possible. So some studies that utilized registries went in and actually contacted the women to try to identify if they were planned home births or not when they were marked as unknown. Additionally, or you could also try to not select variables that you know in your data set to be unreliable. But whatever data set you use, because it can vary on what you have available to you, such as the U.S., we tend to use birth and death certificates because that's what's available to us. Just be very clear and open of what the limitations are of your source data. So when you can address these limitations, they can come into key strengths, and it's these strengths that we want to carry forward into future studies because future research is still needed. In addition to this list, some studies have also provided a more detailed assessment of the deaths attributed to the home births. So since these outcomes are so rare, you might only have like 15 deaths, so you can provide more information of what actually occurred with these infants, such as were they transferred to the hospitals, what interventions they received, what was the actual cause of death, and that helps you get a more clear idea if it was likely the birth location that had a key role in their death. So in conclusion, it appears that for morbidity based solely on APGAR score and admission to NICU, there does appear to be a low risk for the planned home birth. This still holds true for mortality when you look at low-risk women, planned birth location, and knowing the birth attendants. So the review does support the practice of planned home birth as a safe birthing choice for low-risk women when they are assisted by skilled birth attendants and have the ability to be transferred in the case of unexpected complications. However, future research is still needed to fill in these limitations and further assess whether or not there is differences by countries. So this will entail doing additional large-scale population-based cohorts and also looking for new sources of data, such as new large midwifery data registries that are coming here in the U.S. because a randomized control trial is not likely because women will not want to be randomized to a birth location. So thank you.
All right, the floor is open for questions.
Just a comment for the woman from North Carolina. You used the term predictive, mm-hmm. when in fact what you were representing was associations.
Thank you.
I have a comment about home births. I'm in Oregon, and about 3 years ago, at the request of some advocates, we added a question to the birth certificate about whether this was a planned home birth. I would invite people to use that data and look at it independently and see what they find. Now, some early analyses have been done, but not in the last year or so. One of the more surprising things that we found, although in retrospect it isn't that surprising, is that the one study that was done looked solely at the women who had complications. And there were a number of women who were moderate risk who seem to have been insistent on a home birth, even though the midwife suggested against it, which makes some of these interpretations far more complicated than we anticipated.
Yes. Pregnancy medical home provider that in that you have signed a contract agreeing to be a pregnancy medical home with North Carolina Medicaid, as a provider you will get the same rate of reimbursement for vaginal birth as for a C-section. That's not to say that we reimburse the hospitals at the greater rate for vaginal birth, but so it doesn't add quite as much cost to us, but for the individual providers on their claim, yes, they do get the equal rate.
Yes.
Yes, for North Carolina Medicaid. Do you use member incentives?
What do you mean by member incentives?
Well, we have member incentives in California, so we get an incentive for the members of both parties that have both provided hospitals or member incentives for their
So we do not give specific incentives to our patients, if that's what you mean. So what the patient gets is, if they are at high risk of a preterm birth or low birth weight baby, they will be assigned a care manager who will assist them with their pregnancy. But there's no other incentive for them. We haven't done that.
And have you found that the provider incentives?
You know, that's a good question. We haven't, because there's not a good way to measure postpartum visit without the incentive, we can't really compare it that way, and we haven't done an overall evaluation yet for pre and post, because we are in a data blackout right now due to our changeover of Medicaid systems. We have a new system dealing with it, but we hope to do an analysis like that in the next year or two.
You're welcome.
So my question is for the
minute
we just
spoke,
if the incentives work together.
All overall incentives are set. We did a big randomized study coming out of the grant, and all of our incentives show that we are around 3%. And that's one connection, and regardless of whether it's a first time or a third time, we
are around
3%. Yes. That's one of the
episodes. I had a question for Dr. Manchester. I was curious.
To answer the first question, those are kind of on a list of risk factors we can identify from the time data, so there will be a diagnosis code associated with the federal diagnosis code associated with each of those.
I was just curious, and I'm not a clinician, right. So maybe I just don't know like how vomiting is like a risk factor for cesarean versus like I was thinking like obesity, which I didn't see there. Right. Just curious how they were determined like clinically.
Truthfully, a lot of those others are kind of our standard risk factors we use for a variety of different studies. Most of the things on that list were at least somewhat associated with cesarean rates, not necessarily everything, but we're trying to balance just in terms of internal risk and trying to not exclusively risk with cesarean risk.
And then did I miss the part about primary versus secondary?
As far as I know, that's not something we can really differentiate between the data that we have either cesarean or not.
You don't have access to that on the medical.
Yes.
Regarding that same study, I had a question about the birth or the birth attendants. Were they all physicians in that particular study? I was just wondering because I was surprised by the findings about the number of physicians per
I'm not quite sure actually what the question was in terms of.
Sorry, so were all the births that you measured, were they all the attendants?
They were all in a hospital setting. That was kind of the common criteria. Beyond that, we didn't look at.
Yes.
based on where the mom actually lives, not necessarily where the child lives.
Basically, so we had four groups just because of how the data was, you know, the percentages. So we had whites, blacks, there was no significant difference at least. And then there was Latinos, and then there was other races all lumped together. So I can't really,
okay,
you know, make a distinction there.
Okay.
Just well, what I did for that is just look at just women who were, so first, you know, you just control for depression in the whole model. Then what I did is I just looked at those who met the threshold, so the 62% who met this threshold on depression. So you would think those would need mental health counseling, and then I just restricted it to those and ran the regression, and I still found that Latinas were at higher risk of not getting mental health counseling. We don't have that data in the data set. We used the Listening to Mothers 2 survey, so I was limited to what that data set has. So, but that's like an important question for future research to look at why Latinas are getting less mental health counseling. I'm assuming it's partly maybe cultural factors, like, you know, you don't believe in getting mental health care, you just rely on more social support, you do something else, I don't know. But it's definitely an area for future study. Yeah, I guess like the problem with that, the Listening to Mothers survey for that period was that they didn't have a good measure for health insurance. Like, it just asked the women, you know, what part of your bill was paid by Medicaid, by private insurance, by out of pocket. So it's really hard for us to know who had health insurance, who didn't, from that question. But they improved that measure in the Listening to Mother 3 survey. So I'm going to look at that in the Listening to Mother 3 survey, see if I can find different findings around health insurance. Yes?
I have a question for Jessica.
Low birth weight or preterm birth. Those were are only poor birth outcome measures in that.
Okay, so,
yeah.
So
it was the
infant.
Yeah, so women. Yes.
Wow.
So women who had a baby who was not as well off at birth were less likely to go to their prenatal, or sorry, their postpartum visit. But the care management piece, which I feel like I didn't maybe emphasize enough. Women who are at increased risk of having that poor birth outcome are often assigned a care manager. And having a care manager made you more likely to go to your postpartum visit. So that's why we were really excited to see that, because it's kind of paradoxical. It's like, oh, well, these women who have poor birth outcomes are less likely to go to a postpartum visit. But if they had a care manager, they're more likely to go. So it really seems protective, and that's to have a care manager. So that's something that we'd like to pursue.
Yeah, and then
I'm
just curious, like, how many of the visits were combined with like the well baby, like 1 week or 2 weeks checkup? Because I know that when I worked in a clinic, like sometimes we would do that where the mom comes in to get the baby checked, and the provider like squeezes her in for like a postpartum check as well, or make more time for her to, in order to like make her trip worthwhile, like she came all the way to that clinic.
Right. So that's an excellent question, and we don't have the ability currently to match babies to mothers in our data sets. We're working on that. And that would primarily be a pediatrician visit where that well baby check is happening rather than obstetrician. In some of the family medicine settings, it might be that they're doing both. But that's an excellent point, and I'm certain that it does happen, but we don't have the ability to sort of piece that out or parse that out quite yet.
Okay. I'm
sorry?
The criteria is different.
And in order to receive the postpartum incentive payment, they have to have done that postpartum visit within 60 days. So that still would fall in at least to that time frame. But yeah.
I'm Jim Peggy. I'm working in Houston, in Texas. And we're actually working on this with a number of our managed care organizations to get women to come back for the postpartum visit. But one of the items on our agenda is that visit, you know, at 6 weeks is way too late. You can't do that assessment for the postpartum depression. I mean, that's like way up. At 6 weeks, they probably be given a breastfeeding release, so you don't have an intervention time.
Mm-hmm.
You want to see this to change it to 2 weeks. We do see how many of us are working in this field. Maybe we just need to ask them again.
Go ahead and do it.
I mean, so many things changing out here, right? I mean, the hospital is changing. So, I think that's great that they do postpartum screening. My daughter had a baby in Denver, and she did it. But, you know, they're not going to do, like, all of those other things, you know. So, I think maybe all of us working in this field need to talk to HEDIS, because even our providers that say we're getting some of our mothers in because we think it's a value, they don't get to count it, and therefore it counts against them for the managed care organizations. So I just think that, you know, maybe we need a movement to say, come on, change it.
Yeah. Well, the other, and speaking,
they should even go along with that too, because the state of California, where we present that, the doctors are responding, the providers are wanting to see mothers at 1 week, 2 weeks, not only the C-section follow-up.
Yeah, and I mean, you have to, in order to truly be diagnosed with postpartum depression, you have to have had the depression for at least 2 weeks, correct? I believe that's right, at least two weeks. And it might not start to show up for at least a week or two after birth. So I agree that 6 weeks for breastfeeding definitely is too late. But maybe even, like, instead of 2 weeks, maybe 4 weeks, you know, something in that
realm. Well, I think at 2 weeks you could diagnose postpartum psychosis, which is much less prevalent than postpartum depression. And you could also probably look at postpartum blues and see if women, because women who have postpartum blues have higher likelihood of developing postpartum depression. So I guess, like, there are some issues that could be addressed. And I think that one postpartum visit is not enough for women. As I presented, that there are so many longitudinal studies finding that women have several symptoms and problems throughout the first year after childbirth. So we should go for more postpartum visits, like, if anything.
And also, when you look at it, how many of the women are now not low risk, they're more high risk? How many have hypertension problems? I mean, those need to be followed up.
That's right.
Are they not followed up?
Right.
They've had those issues. Again, they may be being seen, but then
if
they're seen, are they counted?
But, you know, this is like going back to the medical model. That's why you have the 6 weeks. That's by 6 weeks, the woman's, like, organs get back to their, you know, uterus gets back to its original shape, original size, and, you know, that's where this postpartum visit happens. But the thing is, that really doesn't acknowledge all the other issues that could happen. And, you know, just, I guess, like, we should try to encourage more postpartum visits, not just that 1 6-week visit.
And I also think what you said about making it valid for the mother. I mean, I think the day before I came to the conference, we had a conference for physicians, and one of our physicians was presenting on the postpartum visit, and he said, well, you know, I never really thought about it that much until you guys asked me to speak on it. And he says, and I paid attention that I didn't pay attention to the fact that I'm not listening to what the mothers are concerned about. So he said, this is very good for me. You know, and I thought that was really interesting, because you said it has to be meaningful.
Oregon grant to survey postpartum women that go to the United States to with CDC money. And we do, so it's a random sample, stratified random sample of births from birth certificates, and then we also do a 2-year follow-up shortly after the baby turns 2. What I'm going to say is about how we understand women who admit that they have depressive symptoms in the immediate postpartum period. I was surprised to find, and I don't think it's been reported much anywhere, is that we ask about depression in PRAM, so typically that's at about 3.5 months postpartum, and we ask some sort of screen two question depressive symptom module. And we ask the same questions when the baby's 25 months old. And when the baby's 25 months old, we ask the mother about her depressive symptoms in the child's first year of life, months 0 to 12 essentially, and then separately asked about months 13 to 24. And we were very surprised to find that when you ask women at 3.5 months whether they had depressive symptoms since the baby was born, somewhere around 11 or 12% of women reported positive. When you ask women at 25 months whether they had depressive symptoms in the first year of the child's life, it's almost 3 times as high. So one of the questions that raises in my mind, and I'm curious if people have experiences or thought about this, is whether the level of denial is so high that women in the immediate postpartum period perceive that, well, this is normal, or I don't want to talk about it. And so we're picking up, I suspect, even when we're doing our best screening, we're picking up certainly less than all of the women who really have depression. And that maybe we need different methods for diagnosis, different methods for screening, and we need to sort of understand somehow that there's a much bigger pool out there than we normally notice.
And it can't be that it's the second part of the first year where they go to depress. And that they won't have reported it at the prom for the first time. But unlikely.
That's certainly a possibility.
Suggestions for FCH section next year?
Well, actually, I have a question for Dr. Bannister. So I was wondering, so these were just, you were basically looking at, like, okay, so the rates of how many OBGYNs per resident within the area, and correlating that with the rate of cesarean sections, right? So basically, you know, you cannot infer like individual level kind of, I guess, inferences.
No, it's very much at a high level.
At a high level.
For sure.
But do you think that's an indication of what could be happening?
I think it's kind of a study that suggests things to look at in other studies.
Like, what would you suggest other studies look at?
I mean, I think it's an interesting finding that, you know, areas where there seems to be a lot of available healthcare resources tend to also be areas where there's high cesarean rates. I think that's kind of the study that I'd like to look at next.
Okay. So, what about, like, the association with income seems to be not direct. So, can you explain more about that?
Yeah, I'm not quite sure what to make of either the educational thing or the income. It's kind of interesting that everything kind of skews towards both the low, very low counties and the very high counties, but really both kind of
in the upper
higher
variance rate. And what do you think, why do you think that it's where, you know, you have more whites and less minorities, that where there are less voices hearing your voice? Would you explain that?
That one, I think, goes a little counter to what people are thinking. I don't know quite what that would mean.
Okay. So it doesn't correlate with anything in the literature about whether minorities ask for their intersections more?
Well, that hasn't, I didn't find anything like that.
Okay.
I don't think that's really been studied.
Okay. Okay. Thank you. Other questions? All right. Thank you very much.